Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Air travel and transport produce a lot of carbon dioxide, and projections are that in the age of the global economy, air travel is only headed up. How do we fly more and pollute less? Right now, there are no global emission standards in the sky, but NASA and others are trying to design more climate-friendly airplanes. This hour on Point, cleaning up air travel and what that will take. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you picture an alternative to those big, dirty jet engines? Like what? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will talk about whether or not Detroit will meet the 2025 EPA auto emission standards, as the big international auto show is going on this week. But first, air travel. Joining me first from San Francisco is Daniel Rutherford, environmental engineer and program director at the International Council on Clean Transportation. Daniel Rutherford, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. We know all about coal-fired plants and automobiles and trucks all over the planet. Air travel is everywhere, but it seems like much smaller in its scale. Does it even matter as a carbon emitter? Does it really matter?
Sure. So as you noted in your introduction, air travel is really a key part of our modern global economy. As a result, the carbon emissions from air emissions are pretty significant. Let me give you a couple of numbers. You often hear that air travel is responsible for between 2 to 3% of global carbon dioxide emissions. Mm-hmm. That's about 700 million metric tons per year. It sounds a little bit small, but if you look at it in some other ways, you get a better understanding of its significance. If you were to treat the global aviation industry as a country, it would be about seventh in terms of overall emissions. So a little less than Germany, but well above Korea. Mm-hmm. And emissions are set to triple by mid-century globally.
From the aviation industry?
That's correct.
We can understand that in the global economy, that kind of travel is expected to grow and grow. I mean, a lot of people, I think, these days, you know, feel some irony. Even those people who were flying in from all over the planet for the big climate conference in Paris might feel a little guilt as they step onto those jet airplanes about all the emissions are going to occur just to get them there. It sounds as though you're saying that's legitimate concern.
Sure, especially if you fly a fair amount for business or in your personal life. Flying can be a big part of your carbon footprint. A lot of my work is to travel to international conferences to talk about how to reduce aviation and shipping emissions. When I ran my own numbers, I found in 2014, aviation, just my personal flying, was responsible for about 40% of my carbon footprint. And when you added my business travel, it was actually more than 80% of my overall carbon footprint. So, yes, even especially for certain people who travel quite a bit, this is a big problem.
So never mind heating or cooling your home or driving your automobile or keeping the lights on. For you personally, 80% of your carbon footprint, CO2 emissions from air travel, that's pretty incredible. Why, if this has got that degree of significance, why was it not on the table in Paris at the climate summit?
You know, I personally didn't attend Paris, but there were a number of groups that were trying to put it on the agenda there. This included both environmental non-governmental organizations, but also the aviation industry itself, which wanted to highlight its commitment to reducing emissions. For some reason, it didn't make it into the final Paris Agreement. That being said, 2016 is really an opportunity. There's the UN agency that regulates aviation emissions, the International Civil Aviation Organization, has a couple of chances this year to put in place new policies to reduce emissions.
But right now, there are no emission standards or limits. I mean, planes go up, they fly. Nobody's putting a cap on what happens up there.
That's right. There are some policies in place in Europe. So if you fly domestically in Europe or you fly intra-Europe, say between France and England, then there is a small, in essence, carbon charge associated with a cap-and-trade system they have. But globally, at the moment, there are no limits on emissions.
Are there better and worse airlines for CO2 emissions, or is it all the same?
There definitely are differences across carriers. We've been researching this since 2010, first for the U.S. domestic market, and then most recently for transatlantic flights. And we were fairly surprised to see that there is a big difference between the airlines. In the U.S., the difference between the most efficient and the least efficient airline was about 25%. That is, the least efficient carrier had about 25% more carbon emissions per passenger mile than the most efficient.
Who was best? Who was worst?
Yeah, so for the U.S., the best carrier was Alaska Airlines, and the worst performing carrier was American Airlines.
What makes the difference? Is it just an older fleet or something else?
It's a combination of factors. Certainly, the aircraft age is a big one. There are also more and less efficient aircraft types. So if you have an aircraft with, for example, winglets on it, it will be more efficient. And then also there are some operational practices which differ across carriers. So some carriers fly more directly than others. Some have higher load factors and use optimized routing practices, et cetera.
What's a winglet, Daniel?
So winglet is a wingtip device. You've probably seen on an airplane. So if you look out the window and you're over the wing, you'll see that there's sort of a tip device on it.
Oh, it tips up at the end of the wing?
Exactly. So that has an effect on reducing fuel consumption by reducing aerodynamic drag over the wing.
Daniel Rutherford with the International Council on Clean Transportation. Please stand by there in San Francisco. I want to bring in a couple of NASA minds who are hard at work on this. From Washington, Jay Dreyer joins us. He's director of Advanced Air Vehicles Program at NASA, manages research to reduce aircraft fuel consumption, emissions, noise. That turns out to matter as well. Jay Dreyer, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Williamsburg, Virginia, Ed Wagoner joins us. Ed is director of NASA's Integrated Aviation Systems Program, just completed a 6-year project called the Environmentally Responsible Aviation Project, developed a raft of promising new technologies there. Ed Wagoner, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you both. Let me ask you first, Jay, is it possible to radically change the CO2 emissions profile of something that's already radical on its face? I mean, picking up a whole bunch of people and all their luggage or cargo and putting it in the sky sounds energy intensive. Is there a way to do this with a radically smaller CO2 footprint?
Yeah, Tom, that's a real good question. And that's one of the things that we're clearly looking at from a NASA perspective. What can we do about a problem like that? And there really isn't one single answer that's going to make those type of changes. You really have to look at everything from the aircraft to the system that it operates. And the way we're looking at the systems analysis that we've done shows, yes, it is possible to see significant reductions in CO2 by improving the efficiency of the aircraft and the air traffic management system. But it's going to take a lot of work across a number of different areas to make that happen.
Ed, is it mainly about the design of the aircraft itself, or is it about how it's operated or everything that goes on the ground? What's the profile of change?
Tom, it's all of the above. It's the airframe, the way it's designed. Daniel mentioned winglets, which back in the 80s were being developed by NASA by a brilliant man named Dick Whitcomb. But it's the airframe, it's all of the components of that, the engines, the wings, the vertical tail, every piece of that, as well as operations. We've seen some dramatic fuel reduction that can come just from the way that the airframe or the aircraft is operated.
Let's start with the airframe. What might that look like if we look, I don't know, let's get radical, look 40 or 50 years down the road. Will they still look, Ed, like commercial aircraft today, passenger airliners? Might they look quite different? If so, how?
Tom, we did a study back in 2010 looking at what innovations might we have in airframe design, and we saw some fairly radical change-looking airframes and changes to what we commonly refer to as a tube and a wing, which is a circular fuselage with a wing stuck on it. Things that would look like a flying wing, perhaps with either the engines embedded within the wing or mounted near the trailing edge, the back end of the aircraft on the upper surface for noise shielding. So there's the possibility there of radical changes, not just in technologies, but also in the design of the airframe that could have a significant impact on the fuel efficiency for the aircraft as well as emissions.
Jay, could you see that? Passengers boarding something that looked like a big boomerang sitting on the tarmac?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you know that we can. When you look at how the society's adopted to a number of new technologies, you know, air travel is just going to be another one that we could see some significant change in. And I think yes, absolutely.
And we don't have to go to dirigibles or hot air balloons or something. We can have high speed air travel and clean air travel. Are you confident in that, Jay?
I am, and the results that we've seen so far are showing that this certainly is a possibility. And even if you look over time about how the efficiency of aircraft have improved, even though from the outside they may look the same, but the performance is you know significantly better than it was, say, back in the 1960s or 70s. And we think that you know by doing some of the things that Ed suggested, for example, looking at new configurations, that could allow us to maybe even take greater steps than what we have coming up to this point. And a lot of it is everything coming together. You know, our ability to model things more accurately, to bring new materials to bear. A lot of this is really coming together right now to work out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about making airplanes, big commercial airliners, more climate friendly. What it's going to take to make air travel cleaner. You can join us this hour. What about it? Do you have a sense of what a big source of CO2 in the atmosphere commercial airliners are? How do we have a global economy, a global world, without big jet engine pollution? Can you picture a better, cleaner way to fly? Aeronautics nuts, talk to us. Have you got an idea? We're wide open right here today. Back in March of 2015, Andre Borschberg, he was a pilot for the Solar Impulse 2, a single-seater plane, only source of power is from the sun, talked with CNBC about the solar-powered plane.
So Solar Impulse is using only the sun as a source of energy. And we can fly day and night. In fact, we can fly a week, we can fly a month, nonstop. So that's the first time we have an airplane which has unlimited endurance.
Great. They can fly for a long time, but they can't carry much. Certainly not, at this point, anything like a plane load of passengers. NASA's looking at not those big two or four or six jet engines hanging under the wing, but lots of mini engines mounted on a wing. Here's some video from NASA, April last year, where they test one engine and then they turn them all on.
Looks good.
All right, going to full power now.
Looks good. Sounds like Angry Bees. What's your RPM?
All motors green.
Sounds like Angry Bees. That's a whole lot of engines mounted on the aircraft there in a NASA test. And I should say there's a gallery of NASA images at our website where you can see some of what they're working on, onpointradio.org. Jay Dreyer and Ed Wagoner are with us from NASA. Jay is the director of the Advanced Air Vehicles Program at NASA headquarters. Ed is director of the Integrated Aviation Systems Program at NASA. Daniel Rutherford is with us as well from San Francisco, program director at the International Council on Clean Transportation. Jay, explain for us big engines versus a lot of mini engines. What's the difference? What's the payoff?
So what you're describing there is something that we call distributed propulsion. And like most people are used to, when they get on a plane, you look, you see two, maybe four engines on the aircraft. big engines, large diameter in the beginning, in the entrance to that under the wing. Mm-hmm. One of the things that makes those more efficient is what we call the high bypass ratio, or how big the fan can be to push the air through that. The bigger, mm-hmm. the more efficient. But that becomes more complex. The larger you make that, the more drag. It also becomes issues with how you're going to install that on the aircraft. Instead, if we take that and break it up into smaller engines and distribute those amongst the airframe, and then we can also play tricks with how well that interfaces with the fuselage, with the wing and other things to get some more additional efficiency to get that type of lift. And so these are the kind of things that we're looking at. How might a concept like that really be practical in the future? So the test that you described there is an example of where we're starting on a smaller scale so that we can understand some of those, what we call the propulsion airframe interaction effects, understand the system better so that we can then scale that up and see how that can work on larger aircraft that can carry the higher payloads that you referenced.
Ed Wagoner, if you go to mini engines embedded all over the aircraft, does that begin to free you up from the tube and wing airframe design?
Well, not necessarily from the tube and wing, but it certainly does give you a lot of latitude in how you could apply those technologies. So it could be to a tube and wing that would be very conventional looking, or it could be to a novel configuration. And it's interesting, just yesterday, Jay and I had a long conversation about the status of this research work and when it's going to be ready to kind of graduate to a more integrated full systems analysis and research work, which I have the responsibility for.
Integrating all of that. And explain why the micro-engines could be more efficient, Ed?
Well, they're more efficient because of as Jay was talking about, the more air that you can move through the propulsion system. So this is a way to do that, to take advantage of the aerodynamics of the wing as well as a propulsion system, and do that in a way that you're not just generating huge engines that have to be integrated onto an airframe, which is a problem within itself.
So we might see what lots of tiny, relatively tiny engines all along the edge of the wing, even would they be on the tube as well, on the body of the aircraft?
We haven't looked at configurations that would have it on the body, but certainly all along the span of the wing.
We've got lots of callers for all three of you. Janet is calling from North Charleston in South Carolina. Janet, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just attended a meeting last week in Florida called Farm to Fly, and they had representatives from some of the biotech companies and the commercial aviation group, Boeing, other people. We look at this as a two-pronged fork. We need to make a more efficient plane, but we also need to switch to something like biofuels that has a much lower carbon footprint.
And were people sounding optimistic there, Janet, about that?
Well, we have the land to do it. South Florida, they've lost 400,000 acres of citrus due to a serious disease, so they have the land to do it, and we have the feedstocks. We're using sugar beet in the winter and tuber in the summer. We can get about 1,800 gallons of ethanol to the acre, and if you turn that into a process like a catalytic process like BYOBY has at Texas A&M, you can turn them into drop-in jet fuel at a very reasonable cost, but you can't get any research money to work on it.
Janet, it sounds like you're all over it. Let me take it to Jay Dreyer. This is right in his wheelhouse. Jay, how about it? Biofuels and jet flight. Are we going to be flying on sugar beets and tubers?
I don't know if I can say if we're going to fly exactly on that, but alternative fuels is certainly something that we're looking at in the future. And NASA plays a role in that as well. In fact, that's one of the areas where it's not just NASA, but really across the federal government, we're really working better together. We've worked on a strategy of how we can integrate, cooperate better, so everyone from the Department of Energy or the USDA that are the folks that are leading that farm to fly type of initiative, how we can understand what they're doing and how where our research can fit in. And so what NASA in particular is doing when it comes to alternative fuels is looking how do we characterize the performance of these fuels in flight, understand the benefits. And so we've just recently completed both ground and flight tests where we've probed aircraft that are using alternative fuels to better understand how well those perform in the real world.
What kind of alternatives, if they're not biofuels, or maybe they are, but what range of alternatives?
So there's different types of fuels, you know, that can come from, and it depends on the feedstock, whether some of them are based on plant-based. There's even the ideas of using algae-based fuels or excess oils. There's a lot of other different ways of creating these type of alternative fuels. So there are folks that are looking at how to produce those fuels. And what we're looking at is how well do those different fuels perform in the aircraft systems? And also, how do you design the engine components, say the combustor that burns the fuel, mm-hmm. that can handle something, the alternative fuels, just as efficiently as it handles the current aviation fuels that we use.
Let's go to Kurt in Brattleboro, Vermont. Kurt, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi,
everybody. I look for a comment from Mr. Rutherford. I think that the public has trouble understanding the real seriousness of pollution that comes from the airlines because they don't see, maybe people don't understand that what's effective at the upper stratosphere is different from what's on ground level. For instance, ozone, we all need our ozone layer, people know that, but ozone is a pollutant at ground level. And in a similar principle, the pollution released by the jets at 30,000 and 35,000 feet mm-hmm. is immediately and devastatingly more pollutive than your automobile exhaust at ground level.
Mm-hmm.
And so isn't it likely that this information is going to be, you know, slow to be realized by the industry, just as, you know, the lead paint was, you know, a brewing issue for decades in the United States, but outlawed in Japan and Europe in 1922.
Slow to be realized, or maybe just slow to be discussed. I'm really glad you raised it, Kurt. Daniel, how about it? You say 2 to 3% of CO2 emissions, but when a lot of that emission happens at 20, 30,000 plus feet, is it more dangerous? Is it devastating, as our caller says?
Sure. It's a great question, and I'm glad it came up. So far, we've only talked about the carbon dioxide emissions, but as the caller notes, 1 gallon of fuel can have more or less of a climate impact depending upon where you burn it. So in the case of planes, where you're burning that gallon of fossil fuel at altitude, there are additional climate impacts. You have emissions of nitrogen oxides, which do lead to additional ozone formation and then some heating from that. There are also some black carbon emissions. And finally, there's considerable uncertainty, but it is believed that that aircraft can contribute to cloud formation, which could also have a climate impact. So the science is still fairly uncertain on this, but clearly it's not just CO2 we have to think about from planes.
You know, sometimes we don't want to think things through because who doesn't like to be able to fly off anywhere in the world that they want to go? Are we kidding ourselves that this can be done cleanly when we're looking at what we're told again and again as a dire threat to the planet? Can we have it both ways, do you think, Dan, in this century? Lots and lots of global air travel and a responsible emissions that might lead to climate change.
Sure. Well, the reality is that demand has been increasing so fast that it's been outstripping technology. That is, you have so many people flying more often and further, and it's the emissions are growing quickly because the efficiency gains to date have not kept up with that. So it is a real issue and a challenge when you have countries talking about making 60 to 80% reductions in their own domestic emissions mm-hmm. by mid-century, and business as usual looks like a threefold increase for aircraft. It is concerning. That being said, there are goals that have been put in place for carbon neutral growth from 2020 from the aviation industry. And 2016 looks to be a good year for finally getting some policies in place to address the issue.
Ed Wagoner, how do you look at that? Are you and Jay and others working on the technology here going to be in a position to bail us out or save us from ourselves before this is seen as just an unacceptable spike in the midst of lots of CO2 contraction elsewhere in the economy in the world?
Tom, we are. And as Daniel said, I mean, the growth in aviation demand, both from passengers and cargo, I mean, we're looking at 2 to 3% per year increases in those demands.
Yeah.
The technologies that we've worked, though, we had very aggressive goals in this environmentally responsible aviation project that we just finished, where we were looking at 50% reduction in fuel burn, 70 to 75% reduction in NOx emissions, as well as another goal that has to do with noise. And so what does that mean? And by the way, the technologies that we worked over this through our analysis shows that we can meet both of those. We can meet the 50% fuel burn reduction. We can meet the 70 to 75% NOx reduction. But what does that mean? So just in a dollar value, if we, the technologies that we worked during this project, if we aggressively integrated those into the commercial fleet, they would save between 2025 and 2050 what we estimate as being $255 billion worth of just fuel. And that translates to over 750 million tons of CO2 being put into the air. And all of these numbers are consistent with what Daniel talked about earlier as far as how many tons of metric tons of CO2 are put into the air right now by the aviation industry and what those increases in cargo and passenger demands are over the next quarter of a century. So we really think the technologies that we're targeting will work. We're working those with industry hand in glove so that the technology transfer is implicit in the way that we're working with our industry partners. So we think that we can make a major dent in the aviation environmental impact.
Sounds good. If you come through with the technology and they come through with the adoption, get it in use and using it. Jason in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jason, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi. My question is directly connected to this subject regarding fuel burn, and that is my stepfather and father were both career aviators. And my stepfather used to say that one of his favorite things was maximum acceleration to liftoff and then maximum acceleration from liftoff to the next plateau or cruising altitude.
What was he flying, Jason? Commercial airline? Passenger airliners? Or for who or what?
My stepfather flew for United Airlines, and my father and stepfather both flew military in World War II.
So you're saying they really wanted to slam that accelerator as they took off. Why?
My stepfather said he enjoyed burning as many tons of fuel as possible.
Why?
And I wonder if there are, you know, if practices have changed to improve the efficiency and lower acceleration. Who has authority over that, and can it be changed?
I will ask, do you know why they loved to slam it as they took off? Is it because they would then weigh less once they got into the air, or it was a safer?
I think because it was a rush. because he could. He had a big aircraft. DC-10s, and they had a lot of power.
Yeah.
I think it was fun for him.
Yeah. Jay Dreyer, what about the way they drive? Is it the same as surging away from a red light? Are pilots changing the way they fly? Does that make a difference?
Well, there certainly are things that you can do about the profile of the aircraft flight that makes it more efficient. And the airlines are paying more attention to that now, because not only from the environmental standpoint, but it comes down to fuel burn and cost, too. So they're tracking those type of things. And so just the way you fly does make a difference. But that comes to the point that I made earlier, where we're not just looking at the aircraft, but also the operations. And so think about another way to look at it is on the landing when you're coming back. Instead of stepping down, for example, and leveling off, we're looking at how do you have a more a gradual descent and at a lower throttle setting that you can come in more efficiently, for example, to burn less fuel and also, you know, improve the noise characteristics and things like that when you land. So we do have teams at NASA that are looking at that, but also in conjunction of how might that also affect the design of aircrafts and things. And this is why we talked about earlier, it's not just one thing, it's really how everything fits together and works together.
People are talking about electric engines as well. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So just in the same way that we see in the automobile side, obviously not an exact correlation to those type of technologies, but one of the things that we've studied is the potential of hybrid electric systems on aircraft. And there's more than one way to do that. Ed referenced some of the studies that we did several years ago, and these are some of the concepts that we have also started looking at as well. And again, that's something that will start smaller as far as a stepping stone to what might be in the future and a spinoff to those small vehicles, but this could be an exciting area of development for us.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about making airplanes, big commercial airliners, more climate friendly. What it's going to take to make air travel flight cleaner. Jay Dreyer and Ed Wagoner are with us from NASA. Daniel Rutherford is with us from the International Council on Clean Transportation. In a few minutes, we're going to look at the International Auto Show and what's happening with auto emissions as oil and gas prices go way down and drivers maybe pay a little bit less attention to fuel efficiency. What are you hearing in what we're learning here today? Heard a little bit there about the possibility of electric power when it comes to flight. This is aerospace engineer, NASA Langley researcher Mark Moore explaining, this is in a NASA video, the difference in efficiency between a typical jet turbine and one with electrical propulsion.
Electric motors, controllers have just made incredible breakthroughs over the last 10 years. We're able to get 4 horsepower per pound out of an electric motor and controller, which is as good as a turbine engine. And for that same electric motor, that's 95% efficient. Well, if you look at a turbine, that's about 45% efficient.
So we've got all kinds of response here from our listeners. Ellen says she heard that a plane ride is equivalent to a year's use of an auto. I guess it depends how much you drive and how far you fly, but that led her to decide to do her traveling via watching travel shows on PBS. And she worries that, she says, I may be old before clean fuels in airplanes are in place. Jay, could you explain for us a little more about the electric element here? Is it teamed up with a jet engine that would still have to have of that kind of burn to produce the jet propulsion, or is it all electric?
It really depends on the size of the aircraft. I mean, even today, we can fly all-electric aircraft for small, say, two-passenger type of aircraft. That's been done and shown. The ranges are still short for some of those flights.
And get a jet or just to power their propellers?
Just for the propeller for an aircraft such as that. But to really scale that to something of an airliner size, that's going to take, that type of technology just won't directly scale. We're not going to put enough batteries in an aircraft that today with today's technology and be able to do something like that. So what we're looking at is what are the possible paths to that type of solution? And so the hybrid electric solution could be a potential area there where you still would have a turbine engine, but you could use some batteries, fuel cells, or other energy source during certain phases of the flight to make the overall mission more efficient. It also gives you some options on how you could reconfigure the aircraft depending on the type of mission it's going to fly and things like that. So, and again, these might be also enablers for perhaps more efficient distributed electric propulsion like we talked about earlier, and help with some of those concepts as well. So there's another of options. There's not one path. And that's one of the things that we're looking at, NASA, is the overall system benefits, how you might do something like this, as well as some of the critical technologies like the high power density motors that you might need.
Judge asks on Twitter, says, knowing that jet fuel is basically kerosene, is there really a possibility for bio-kerosene, like biodiesel?
We've already been flying aircraft with biofuels.
It's happening. It's out there.
It's happening. In fact, we've done our tests ourselves where we used an aircraft where we could run biofuels from some of the engines and other fuel from the others, and actually took other aircraft behind it so that we could sample the effects in flight.
Ed, you mentioned noise earlier in passing. What's the relevance of noise to this issue of efficiency and CO2 emission?
Well, we're looking at the fuel efficiency and noise from a system standpoint. So not looking at just one aspect of it, but make sure that it integrates together so that you wouldn't be generating fuel efficiency while increasing the noise. So we're looking at having all of those worked together. And when you introduced me and you talked about integrated systems, that's how we're looking at this from an integrated point of view, so that you're not trading trading one for the other necessarily, that you're looking at all of that, trying to reduce fuel burn, noise, and emissions all simultaneously.
Is it also that you wouldn't have to avoid population centers if you have a very quiet flight?
Well, what we would do, it wouldn't be restricted in population centers. That's what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at significant, very aggressive noise reduction. And one of the key things that we're doing there is putting the engines, allowing the wing to shield some of the noise from the ground by putting the engines on top of the wing instead of below the wing necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so then that way, you get the noise shielding, but mm-hmm. then you may have other issues associated with the mounting. So we make sure that we're not then increasing fuel burn because of the noise shielding. So that's how we're working all of these technologies together.
Rick in Boston. Rick, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question for you and your guests is, what if airline flights were a little bit more like space launches? So you put a tremendous amount of energy in a burst into gaining altitude, and then you shut down completely and glide to your destination, wherever it happens to be, so there'd be no fuel consumed during the majority of the flight time. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Great. I'm definitely going to fasten my seatbelt for that one. I can see all the passengers floating. But, Jay, how about it?
Yeah, I think we haven't looked at a concept quite like that yet. And part of the issue that you're going to run to is for the great distances that aircraft are going to travel, that would be a tremendous initial speed, you know, for the passenger comfort, but also from an efficiency standpoint of how fast you would have to make the aircraft, how strong the weight that would mm-hmm. go into it to survive such a flight profile. But we are looking at how you do tune the energy use over the profile of the flight, even with the traditional systems that we have, or like in the hybrid electric that I was just talking about as well. So that concept of how we control the energy use over the flight is something that is certainly important in our research.
Carl in Upton, Massachusetts. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. As an airline pilot, I thought I might have a story that would help your listeners understand just how much fuel is really being burned by an airplane. I fly a pretty small wide-body aircraft from New York to Europe fairly often, a 767.
Okay.
Probably on the smaller side of what we use as an industry. 200 people going to Europe, I believe happens probably over 1,000 times a day in each direction for all airlines combined.
Yep.
So for my little airplane going to the far side of Europe from New York, the equivalent of taking my in-ground swimming pool and throwing it in the gas tanks and burning it. One way, one airplane. Small airplane.
How many gallons? 20,000 gallons.
20,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot. What do you hear in our conversation today, Carl? Do you feel some confidence that we can have that kind of easy international air travel and bring down the climate impacts?
I see a lot of things at the fringes happening. But ultimately, to quote Clinton, it's math, it's physics. You know, to get weight into the air is going to take burning a lot of gas. And you might save some percentages, but I don't see how you're going to truly turn this industry like an electric automobile or something like that. It's always going to be a big consumer of fuel.
Carl, I appreciate your call. Daniel Rutherford, could you see a point at which we say, whoops, we thought we could do this, but we can't. We want so much weight up there, people and their carry-ons and their luggage and everything else. It just is too dirty. Climate's changing. We can't do it. Stay home. Watch that foreign destination on TV.
Well, I'm not going to argue with the physics, and certainly not with a pilot on that. It's possible. However, we're just really in step one here. We're working on the technology. We're starting to put some policies in place to reduce emissions. So I think we need to focus there and see how far we can go in the midterm.
Well, we've got it in a spotlight here today, and very happily done it with all three of you. Lots of good insight, and I'm grateful for it. Daniel Rutherford at the International Council on Clean Transportation. Thank you so much for being with us today, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Jay Dreyer in Washington, Director of the Advanced Air Vehicles Program at NASA. Jay, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you. And remember, NASA's with you when you fly.
We'll try. Ed Wagoner, Director of the Integrated Aviation Systems Program at NASA. Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
In a moment, we'll look at auto emissions and the North American International Auto Show. This is On Point. Let's turn from planes to cars. The North American International Auto Show opened Monday in Detroit. Sales are at record highs. How clean are the cars that are coming? Will they meet the tough new EPA standards looming in 2025? Joining me now from Washington is David Shepardson, reporter for Reuters covering technology and regulation, former D.C. bureau chief for the Detroit News. He was at the North American International Auto Show earlier this week. David Shepardson, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
We're hearing a lot about smart cars, artificial intelligence in cars, cars that drive themselves. What about in this period of very low oil prices and gas prices following? What about auto emissions and where they're headed? What's being shown off or not shown off at the auto show?
Well, there is a lot of good news in that the industry continues to roll out a number of zero-emission and plug-in electric hybrid vehicles, in part because California and about a dozen other states are mandating a rising number of zero-emission vehicles to address overall greenhouse gas emissions. But while the fleet is getting more efficient, all types of vehicles, even trucks and SUVs, are far more efficient than they used to be. Americans last year shifted dramatically away from cars toward bigger vehicles, crossovers and SUVs, and as a result, the fleet as a whole is not rising. The efficiency is not rising as fast as many had predicted. In fact, according to one study, it went down slightly in 2015. So that does pose a real question about whether the Obama administration's aggressive plan to nearly double fleet-wide efficiency to 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025 in a nearly 12-year period, whether that's feasible, and the administration is beginning this midterm review process to determine if the final 5 years of those mandates are feasible.
Pretty central to what was promised in Paris around the climate. I mean, at least at this point, the auto companies are showing these things off. Here's a little bit of sound. This is one of the new vehicles anticipated for next year, the Chrysler 2017 Hybrid Pacific. It's a hybrid minivan. Here's Timothy Koniskis, head of passenger car brands North America for Chrysler, at the auto show unveiling it.
The 2017 Pacifica has everything our customers have asked for. 8-passenger seating or 80 miles per gallon. The world's first, the world's only 80-mile-per-gallon hybrid minivan.
David Shepardson, 8-passenger seating and 80 miles per gallon there from the auto show. That sounds like, in a minivan, that sounds like incredible progress.
That is pretty good. Remember, that figure is a combination of electric-only range and gasoline. So it's not actually traveling 80 miles on 1 gallon of gas. It's an average of the battery plus the gasoline. But no, it certainly says that the auto companies have been working for years and, in fact, began a lot of these development projects when gas was at $4 a gallon to build these more efficient cars. And I think the other thing you hear from the auto executives is, yes, we're in a very low gas price environment, and certainly the Energy Department thinks these low gas prices could be here another year or two, depending on the world economy. But all the executives are convinced that oil prices at some point will return to higher, more traditional levels, and then there'll be more demand. And the other issue is, will battery prices and chemistry get better so you can have longer ranges? I mean, GM, General Motors, unveiled a small electric vehicle that will get 200 miles of range on a single charge, and they're convinced that that longer range, about twice what the Nissan Leaf electric vehicle gets, will be enough to satisfy some consumers who are concerned about range anxiety and getting stuck by the side of the road if they run out of juice.
I mean, we all have the sense, the understanding that lower emission standards are out there. But what's actually happening with average fuel economy of new vehicles sold in this country, David?
Well, the EPA official numbers are about a year and a half behind today, and those show, as of the 2014 model year, that the companies are still on pace, in part because in the early years of the standards, they had significantly exceeded the numbers. But this year, again, according to the University of Michigan study, fleet-wide fuel economy was down slightly, and again, that was because more buyers were shifting away from cars toward SUVs and crossovers, which means even though those are more efficient than their predecessors, the fleet went down. No, it's about up about 5 miles per gallon on average over 5 years ago, but to get to where the administration has targeted relies on Americans going to dealerships and buying more fuel-efficient vehicles. And if they don't, and if they opt to sort of return to the habits of the past, then there will be some real challenges. The only other point to remember is that these standards are a series of small targets. So it's not as if all vehicles have to hit 54.5, but based on the footprint or the relative size of each class of vehicle, they have to meet differing targets. So even if there's no change in the standard, legally, the fleet-wide average may be substantially lower than 54.5 in 2025 based on the mix of vehicles that people are buying.
I mean, there seems to be a lot of mumbling about standing down from that goal, 54.5 by 2025. If that were renegotiated or changed, how might that happen? How would it happen?
So two things. Remember when this agreement was announced by President Obama, the administration made one major concession to the U.S. auto companies, and it changed the speed of the curve for the final years for light trucks, for pickups and SUVs. So cars have to average 5% increases per year for the life of the agreement through 2025, whereas the bigger vehicles only have to average 3.5% per year for the first 5 years, and then starting in 2021, those bigger vehicles also have to average 5%. So that's one of the reasons per year. That's one of the reasons this midterm review, which will be finalized by April 2018, is such a big deal, because there's a lot of grumbling and concern among the automakers that will the trucks be able to meet these more aggressive of increases. So certainly a lot rides on it, and you're right, I mean, the transportation sector is one of the largest sources of emissions and also one of the most heavily regulated, and if the administration, or obviously it will be a future president, will have to make the final decision about whether these standards are relaxed or increased, which is what the law also says, and that'll have a big impact on what the U.S. emissions footprint looks in 2025 and beyond.
Promises made in Paris, but we'll have a new president well before 2018, and big decisions being made. A lot of decisions being made, as David Shepardson points out, by consumers every time they buy a car as well. David Shepardson, reporter with Reuters, thank you so much for joining us for a minute today.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.